Welcome to your Thursday edition of What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. So glad to have you listening to the podcast today. We have really had some exciting episodes over the past few days, and I would encourage you to go back and download some of the shows. We had Women's Day on Tuesday, just a fabulous trio of highly respected North Carolina women giving their input and their insights, their perspective on the whole Donald Trump video and the presidential campaign and North Carolina politics. So please go ahead and download that and listen to it at your leisure. Very good show. Yesterday, we talked about the tax study that has been released by the Civitas Institute. It was a tax study that was put together and authored by some folks at High Point University. And we were able to have them on the program yesterday talking about just the fabulous economic, exciting news that just keeps going and going and going in North Carolina. Really amazing that the tax reforms that have been implemented in our state over the past several years have resulted in such a quick turnaround. I mean, on the surface, it doesn't make any sense. The Republicans that took over the majority of the General Assembly in 2011, they were faced with a $3 billion budget deficit. Soon enough, they found out that the unemployment program owed the federal government $2.5 billion. I mean, when you're so far in the hole, don't you need to raise taxes and get the revenue up from the people so that these things can be paid off? Well, no. Surprisingly enough, Dr. Louis DiBicco and Dr. Stephanie Crofton from High Point, they did a study and they showed that the aggressive tax reform measures that were implemented by the Republican majority in the North Carolina General Assembly actually led to more jobs and bigger paychecks. And we also had Senator Bob Rucho on the show. He was the principal architect of the tax reforms, the unemployment insurance reforms that were made by the General Assembly. And he talked about what it was like to walk in on day one and be $3 billion in the hole because the previous majority had done such a poor job of managing the state's finances. He talks about what they did to tackle the problems. And also, you know, a good point to make, and Senator Rucho made the point, and it's really sad, but the media is not covering the great economic news in North Carolina. They're ignoring it. And so it's like, you know, if you're a conservative, you're not only fighting against liberals, but you're also fighting against the media. But Senator Rucho obviously retired, but he'll always be Senator Rucho to me. I have great respect for him. When I worked down there, he was always pleasant and yet very focused on trying to turn the state around. And he warns of the dangers of going back to a liberal tax and spend mindset. So one of the most important programs that we have done to date, talking about the incredible aggressive reforms that the General Assembly had to make and that worked. Our state is doing so well on so many different levels. Low unemployment, growth, teacher pay raises, median income is up. You know, the left would like to say that, well, the only thing that's happening is that the rich are getting richer. And this is just a lie. It's not true. And this tax study, by the way, will point that out very much in resounding fashion, the fact that the middle class people across the state are benefiting from tax reform, from unemployment insurance reform. And so you can go to morejobsbiggerpaychecks.com and read all about it. Look at the study. It's very easy to read. It's not one of these, you know, high-end economic things that somebody like me looks at and kind of gets glazed look on their face, but it's something that you can understand easily. And it points out, by the way, this is an academic study, and it points out that the state has done well, very, very well as a result of the aggressive tax reforms and unemployment insurance reforms that the North Carolina General Assembly have made under the direction and leadership of the Republican majority since 2011. Now, not trying to be partisan here in any way, as you know, but the fact is that the Democrats were in the majority for years, and now the Republicans are in the majority. And they are the ones who have instituted these reforms that have brought our state into such a fabulous economic position. And it's, you know, from all intents and purposes, it looks like it will continue. Obviously, both Dr. DiBicco and Crofton said, you know what, these things are cyclical. The economy goes up, It goes down, it expands, it contracts, and certainly there will probably be another recession. But here's the big difference. The Republican majority in the General Assembly has said, you know what, let's get ready for that. There's over $1 billion in the Unemployment Insurance Reserve Fund, and there's billions in the State Emergency Fund. I don't know the exact amount off the top of my head, but here's candidate for governor Roy Cooper saying, oh, well, y'all are putting too much money in the rainy day fund. Well, that's really not very wise to say. I can think of a couple of other words to describe that comment, but I will not use them. But how can you sit there in the midst of incredible uncertainty in the economy and say, well, they shouldn't be saving money? And now, with people underwater, with farms and families displaced, all of the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew, and to go around saying, you know, they need to be spending more money, well, that's just, to me, not very smart. And it proves that I don't think the Attorney General is really fully cognizant of what it would take to be an effective governor. Governor McCrory has been going around and doing a tremendous job in the aftermath of this storm, providing leadership and confidence, and also making sure that people know that North Carolina's emergency responders and people that can help are on the ball. And so I think you have to tip your hat to Governor McCrory for his handling of this situation. But to go around and say, well, they're putting too much money aside, that's the problem. That's one of the problems that the Democrat majority had. Folks, do you remember? You may not remember this. I was in radio at the time, and we covered this extensively. There was a nearly $2 billion budget surplus in 2006, 2007. And the Democrat majority at that time, there was a lot. We took phone calls from people saying, what should they do? And a lot of people said, give it back to the taxpayers. A lot of people said, set the money aside. Well, what did they do? Yep, just in fine Democrat fashion, they spent it all. Blew right through it like a guy at a blackjack table in Las Vegas. And suddenly, boom, recession. No money saved, and incredible difficult time for the state. And when it was all said and done, teacher pay was frozen. Do you remember that? The Democrats like to tout themselves as the party of compassion for teachers, and yet they froze their pay scale. And so, you know, I think it's clear that the direction the state is in under conservative leadership, being wise, putting money aside, funding education, the largest teacher pay raise maybe in the history of the state, average teacher pay now up to $50,000 a year, 300,000 net new jobs in the last several years. I mean, folks, our state is doing great. Our state is doing great. And this is why I encourage you, please share this program with your friends and your family, because you're not going to turn on your local news. You're not going to open your local paper and hear the truth. You have got to get the word out to your friends and family. Encourage them to go to freedomactionnetwork.com and subscribe to What Matters in North Carolina. Get the podcast delivered to your phone or your computer every single day and listen to the truth, because it will help you be not only more understanding of what's going on in our state, but you'll be able to share it with others. And so we appreciate you doing that. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk with Bob Liebke of the Civitas Institute about football and colleges and student fees. And he's written an excellent piece on that, and we'll dive into that in just a few moments. We've also got a time scheduled to talk with Dr. Andy Taylor. He will be our guest, and of course, you know, he's an excellent political analyst, professor of political science at NC State, and we're looking forward to that. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC. We would love to engage with you on social media. You can also find us on Facebook, What Matters in North Carolina. And if you'd like to yell at me, you can do that on Twitter at Mark Shiver. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina, Dr. Andy Taylor. He is a political science professor at NC State University. And Dr. Taylor, since we last spoke, a lot has happened, hasn't it?
Yes, a tremendous amount, Mark, a tremendous amount. Presidential race is really providing interesting twists and turns every moment of the day, it seems. We've had debates, we've had interesting revelations about the personal life of Donald Trump. It's just been fascinating. And then we've got a gubernatorial race which continues to be competitive. Governor McCrory and Attorney General Cooper have had a debate, which I thought was really revealing the other night. They're going to have another one. And we've got a U.S. Senate race in the state that has turned out to be very competitive, and the National Democratic and Republican parties are eyeing it very closely. So it has been a very dramatic election season, that's for sure.
Well, as we look at the interesting thing to me, Dr. Taylor, was, and of course we're a few days away from this now, but the debate Sunday night, I thought the timing of that debate was very favorable to Donald Trump. And my rationale is that he was able to get in front of the American people after that, you know, that video came out with the language that many, most everyone found offensive. And he was able to get on the television and attack Hillary Clinton. And I felt like the timing of that, in other words, if the debate had dragged on, say it had been a week or 10 days away, I think it was to his advantage to have the debate a couple of days after that.
Yeah,
what do you think?
I agree with that, Mark. I think he needed to stem the tide, and the debate provides an ideal opportunity for that. And there was some sort of shoring up of the party and supporters after his performance. I thought he did much better in the second debate than he did in the first debate. And I think it's hard to say who won the debate, the second debate. I mean, it was clear Secretary Clinton won the first debate. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But the second debate, much stronger performance from Trump. The real thing that's hurt him, though, I think, since then is that he, in response to a question by Anderson Cooper, said, you know, I never did that stuff. It's a locker room talk. I didn't do it. It's just bravado. And you know, whatever you think about whether that's true or not, he did say that those actual instances never occurred. But now we have some revelations of women coming out saying, well, it did, and it happened to me. So it's going to be really interesting to see how the Trump campaign scrambles after that. But your general question with regards to the timing of the debate being fortuitous for him, I think I agree with that.
Well, our guest is Dr. Andy Taylor, excellent professor of political science at NC State University. And Dr. Taylor, I agree with you. I think that Donald Trump, his personal performance as a debater was much better this time than it was in the first debate. And I think that he did something that a lot of people, I won't say most, but a lot of people had been sort of waiting for, which was this taking the attack to Hillary Clinton and mentioning the email server and mentioning, you know, the Benghazi and her husband's, you know, sexual situations. And I think a lot of people were, I don't know if it was a majority, but at least a lot of his supporters anyway, were glad to finally see that happen. Do you think that played well with those who were watching?
Yeah. I mean, there was a sense that from his supporters that he needed to go on the offensive and try to take it a little bit more to Secretary Clinton than he'd done in the first debate. And certainly he came in prepared to do that, and he brought up the private server email situation when she was Secretary of State. He brought up Benghazi, and of course he brought up the issue of Bill Clinton's behavior and trying to sort of say, look, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And by implication, it's not just about Bill Clinton, it's about Secretary Clinton as a sort of an enabler of that and helping hide it and going after the women who had accused Bill Clinton of sexual abuse. So that was helpful, and I think better for him. He, you know, Trump has some signature positions on issues that are really thought out, and he's very strong on, particularly immigration, particularly trade, and particularly tax policy, where he demonstrates his sort of acumen as a businessman and someone who understands business. I thought he also did well on the Obamacare question, and that's obviously a weak point for Clinton, not least because of what Bill Clinton said about Obamacare recently, that, you know, you'd be crazy to support it. But he still has some trouble with other issues. Once we got talking about foreign policy in the Middle East, there was revealed his difference of opinion on Syria policy with vice presidential candidate Mike Pence, which I think was a problem. And he suggested that, I think implicit in some of the things he was saying, or I think it was the viewers could read into some of the things he was saying, that he wasn't quite sure of where he stood on some of these foreign policy issues. So, yes, it was a stronger debate, largely because of the counteroffensive. He was doing better on the issues, but sometimes he still has a problem really hitting back on substantive policy matters.
Dr. Taylor, it was interesting to watch Hillary Clinton's demeanor, and I wanted to get your thoughts on how much does demeanor really matter in a debate? Because here was Donald Trump. A lot of people have made much of his walking around and kind of pacing, kind of anxious, not settled. Secretary Clinton would sit down, and then after everything he said, she would sort of lean her head back and laugh. And the first couple of times she did it, as I was viewing, I thought, well, that's kind of effective. But after about the 12th time, you know, I was thinking, boy, this certainly is annoying and very disingenuous. Do you think any of those demeanor questions had any influence on people as they watched?
Maybe in terms of how they viewed the debate. A couple of things about that. First of all, the public doesn't really generally like either of them very much.
And
we've seen that in the data, Mark. And so, you know, if you don't like, that on this particular case you're talking about Clinton, if you don't like Secretary Clinton, you're going to say, well, yeah, look at that smugness, lack of seriousness, lack of respect for her opponent. And if you do like her, you're only voting for her largely because you think she's better than Donald Trump, or you are close to her positions on issues. You're not really voting for her based upon character. We see that in the polls time and time again. So you're going to sort of say, well, that's just who she is, but I'm really voting for her because of her position on issue X, Y, and Z. So I think the voters really see these people as deeply flawed human beings. And that might have an effect on someone who voters generally think is a great person and a nice guy. In 2008, for example, although the 2008 election ended up being a fairly sizable victory for then-Senator Barack Obama, both people genuinely liked Obama and McCain. They thought they were pretty solid human beings. That's not what you get this time. And so voters, I think, just write those things off as the cost of doing business of dealing with these two people. I agree with you too that you know, she does, that does can rub people up the wrong way. I will say this in defense of both candidates, though. They're, you know, 90 minutes under that glare.
Yeah.
You know, when your pulse is racing, you've got tens of millions of people watching you. Your campaign is, you know, on a knife edge, really. You could really mess up.
Yeah.
It is going to be very difficult to control those kinds of human natural reactions to things. And I don't know whether others, but I tend to sort of let those things go and try to listen to what they say rather than perhaps how they look when the other candidate is speaking.
Now, what's interesting, and I want to talk about North Carolina in just a moment, but I have one more national question for you. What I found interesting is a recent conversation that I had with someone who is very active in their church. And I think that many are calling this the evangelical dilemma now, because the evangelicals typically vote conservative, and yet they find themselves with a candidate whose moral issues are, you know, just anathema to what they believe. And so on the one hand, a lot of evangelicals don't want to vote for Secretary Clinton because of her stance on abortion and other liberal policies like that. And then on the other hand, they don't want to vote for Donald Trump because, you know, a lack of humility, his narcissism, his brash, inappropriate speech. And so my question is, what do you think the evangelicals will do? I know nobody knows, but if you had to forecast, are they going to just hold their nose and vote for Trump? Are they just not going to fill out anything on the presidential line? This is a real dilemma.
And I think, you know, it may well be that they're not a cohesive unit in this election, that you sort of get a large group of people who do hold their nose and vote for Trump, but an equally large group of evangelicals who decide to sit it out. That's entirely plausible. It is a dilemma. You know, comes down, Mark, to an issue of policy or character. And we've heard a lot in the past, to be perfectly frank with you, Christian conservatives, evangelicals, saying that character matters. And if character matters, then it's hard to justify a vote for Trump, regardless of the nature of the policy differences between Trump and Clinton. Obviously, if policy matters and character doesn't, then it would make sense to vote for Trump. But I think as an individual Christian, we'll look back and sort of say, okay, if character doesn't matter in this election, and I'm going to vote for Trump, then it's going to seem a large, very hypocritical and inconsistent to start saying, okay, from now on, character matters.
Yeah.
So this is a real dilemma, and I think you summarized it pretty well. My thinking is that as a group of the electorate, that we identify groups of the electorate by these kinds of demographic characteristics. If we talk about Christian conservatives or evangelicals, my sense is that when you see the exit poll data after the election, that they will be scattered because this is such a dilemma.
Well, that's certainly very plausible, and I think that you will probably be proven to be accurate in that forecast. It's just so interesting to hear, and I don't mean to belabor this point, but to hear nationally known figures, you know, in the Christian conservative movement, some of them, you know, distancing themselves as quickly as possible from Trump, others saying that he's had a conversion experience and we need to stick with him. And so I'll tell you, this election is all over the place. It really has something for everybody. If you wait long enough, you'll get something that interests you, no doubt.
Yeah, that's a good point. But I think it's just indicative of the problems that Trump faces. You know, as a Republican candidate in a presidential election trying to create a national majority coalition, that you need a lot of different groups, but one of them that you need to be unified and motivated are Christian conservatives. And it's pretty clear, as we said, they're not. And that's a bad sign for him.
Well, let's talk about North Carolina with our guest, Dr. Andy Taylor, political science professor at NC State University. I thought personally, in fact, I just posted a column this morning, my opinion, that I thought Governor McCrory did very, very well in his debate with Roy Cooper, the Attorney General. What were your thoughts?
Oh, I agree totally. I thought that we just talked about the second presidential debate, which were where we sort of said, oh, I'm not really sure who won. I thought this was pretty conclusive, rather like the first presidential debate, where I thought it was pretty clear that Secretary Clinton won. I thought Governor McCrory won hands down on Tuesday night. I thought he was in command of the issues. He was confident. They went in there with a game plan. They executed it very well. He had the Attorney General Cooper kind of on the back foot. He had the Attorney General really repeating answers to different questions. I just thought it was a really solid performance. I was doing some media with some other people that night for Curtis Media, and we were talking a little bit about before the debate as to whether the hurricane and the pressures of dealing with that and the lack of sleep would affect the governor. and may put him at a sort of a disadvantage. But he obviously had his 5-hour energy before he went in there, because he was on the top of his game, and I think it was pretty clear he won last Tuesday night. And if I was, you know, in the Cooper campaign, I'd be pretty disappointed. You know, that they've got a lead in the polls, it seems. They've got McCrory on the ropes, and this was an opportunity to sort of say, okay, there are a lot of people who have doubts about the governor for a variety of different issues, and maybe we'll talk about those in a minute. But voters need to know, so they have a reason not to vote for McCrory, but they need a reason to vote for Cooper, and he just didn't present that reason at all, I thought, on Tuesday night. And so if I was in the Cooper camp, I would be disappointed.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And some of what I had to share, Dr. Taylor, was that I felt like here we go again with what I call tired talking points. There was really no substance, I felt, in the answers that Attorney General Cooper had to give. Just almost everything the governor said was met with, well, he's distorting his record again, and there was really no evidence of that. I also find saying, you know, I'll be a jobs governor a little redundant. That would be like asking someone who's sitting in a chair to have a seat. I mean, 300,000 net new jobs in the last several years is pretty strong, and it's very interesting to try to call yourselves a jobs governor when we seem to be doing well in that regard. But nevertheless, do you think that this leadership opportunity that Hurricane Matthew has placed before Governor McCrory will help him in the polls? Does this sort of thing typically help a candidate when suddenly, you know, they have to be governor or they have to be president or, you know, whatever?
Yeah, I think so. You know, yes, typically it does. As a chief executive, you're in charge of when crises occur. It's not you don't look to legislatures for solutions to crises. You look to chief executives, whether that be governor or president or in a city, a mayor. And it's their job to solve these problems. It's their job to corral the organization of government, put it to work, getting people back to where they were before the crisis hit. And Governor McCrory has been around the state actively trying to do that. And all indications are at the moment that he's doing a really good job at it. And, you know, it may be, and it will be well after the election, of course, that we'll be able to do this, but maybe at some time in the future, people will look back to the response to Hurricane Matthew in the state and possibly be able to criticize the governor here or there on one little thing or one other thing. But I think generally we'll look back and say the performance was good. And so I think it's going to be positive for him in the election. It's still a month away.
Yeah.
And I think there'll be other issues. And of course, it's only affecting the eastern and southern part of the state. There are large areas of the state that really weren't touched by the hurricane particularly, and it might not matter there, but I think the management thing is helping him. Of course, the Attorney General is trying to get in on some of the action by
right.
sort of saying, don't forget to report price gouging, and I'm here managing the situation as well, but clearly this is the governor's bailiwick, and I think he's doing a good job.
Dr. Taylor, we've got a debate tonight between Senator Burr and his opponent, Deborah Ross, a former member of the North Carolina General Assembly. And that race has been sort of back and forth. She has snugged up against him in the polls, and then he has eased out. And then, you know, it's kind of been a back and forth that we've seen there. Neither one of them have been able to really take a lead and run with it. Is this debate important tonight, do you think?
I think it's important. It's particularly probably important. Well, it's important for both of them. It's particularly important for Deborah Ross, I think, who many people in the state don't know. People who are skeptical of her are probably skeptical because of some of the ways that she's been framed in the Burr campaign advertising. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's particularly important for her. The race is very close, as you noted, Mark. There is going to be a lot of advertising on this race in the next 4 weeks, because both the National Republican and National Democratic parties understand that this is a close race. They're in locking horns in contest for control of the U.S. Senate. This race could be determinative of that. So there's going to be a lot of advertising, but you've only really got this one opportunity to see them going up against each other, interacting with one another. And so although it's highly likely that very few people will watch it, if there is a pivotal moment, if there is a mistake, if there is something interesting that happens, of course, it's picked up and played in news stories for a while afterwards. So, it's an important date in that campaign, with only, you know, less than 4 weeks to go.
Well, here's another theoretical question as we wind this up, Dr. Taylor, and thank you as always for your time. But we talked about the dilemma that many people of faith, Christian conservatives, evangelicals, may be facing nationally with the choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I think that there's also a dilemma brewing across the country among just regular conservatives who are dissatisfied with the way that Republicans in Congress have voted and the things that they have and have not done. For example, the continuing resolution which recently passed with a Republican majority in the House and the Senate, every single edict or program that under the executive branch that President Obama has asserted, such as the transgender edict and his immigration edict and the other things like funding for Planned Parenthood, things that conservatives just find, you know, horrific, they were all funded. There were the Republicans, it was as if who's in charge or who's really in the majority. And do you see because Trump tapped into that to an extent in the primary, do you see a groundswell after this election that will continue to grow of people who are dissatisfied with, you know, the GOP and those that they have sent there to represent them in Congress? Or might this be a passing thing?
Well, I don't think it's a passing thing. I mean, I think it's been there for a while. And Trump, in many ways, didn't really invent it. I mean, he's actually a result of it rather than a cause of it. On the budget situation, the passage of the CR and the funding of government operations through to December the 9th, a lot of that is driven by the election and not necessarily marked by, you know, trying to create a certain kind of policy that will win over large numbers of voters, but purely the logistics of saying it's not going to help us have a drag down knockout fight in Washington for 3 or 4 weeks when really what the voters want to hear is a debate during a real campaign. Let's talk about issues, multiple issues, not just the budget. And so I think it made sense to do that, get out of town, get back, and start trying to win an election and have a real full debate with your opponent in front of the voters. They're going to have to do it again for December the 9th. A lot of that will be dependent upon the election results, of course. But I don't think this sort of general discontent with the way Washington is going, a concern that Washington politicians, members of Congress, and presidents are out of touch with the real problems that everyday Americans are facing. I don't think that will change. I think people are no one's going to fall in love with Washington overnight after this election. It might even get worse. So these kinds of issues are going to be around for a while, and policymakers are going to have to deal with them. And it's dragging them in different directions. That's what being a member of Congress is all about. You need to try to solve these problems as best as you can.
Yeah. Well, I guess I was just wondering if you think we might see another type of Tea Party emerge from all of this, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I don't think the Tea Party's really gone. And I, as I said, I think these attitudes are still in place. It's possible that with a President Clinton, that we might have a 2018 midterm election that has a feel possibly like 2010. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dr. Taylor, thank you very much, as always, for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina. And we will look forward to tonight's debate and to having you back on the program in the near future. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
All right. It's football season, and football in North Carolina is something that definitely matters. So it's our pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina, Dr. Bob Lipke of the Civitas Institute, education policy analyst. And Bob's written a piece called College Football, The Spending Continues. Bob, welcome back.
Good to be here, Mark.
And before we get into your piece, let's talk about something that's really important. The Green Bay Packers, I just found out that you share my fandom, so that's good to know.
Yes, I have been a lifelong Packers fan like yourself. Having grown up in Wisconsin, I think it's part of the birthright there.
Exactly. Well, the very first football game that I ever watched was Super Bowl II when they beat Oakland, and I've been hooked ever since. So anyway, we could talk for a long time about
welcome
that.
Welcome to the family.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we need to go down that path, but we're going to talk about some excellent work that you have done. Now, before we get into the meat of your post here at ncivitas.org, when you start talking about college athletics, it's like a spider. There are a lot of different legs that come out there that drive this phenomenon. And clearly the most visible one, Bob, is that next to the NFL, college football is the most watched and most revered and most fan excitable sport that we have right now. So if you start trying to tinker with it, you know, that's tough going.
Yeah, football is definitely the most popular college sport by a long shot, if no matter what criteria you use on it. But why that's important is because, as I say, it drives the bus. It pays the bills. And if you tinker with it, you're also tinkering with the budgets of other sports. I mean, there are other income sports, such as basketball and volleyball in some places, and in some places also hockey. But by and large, football drives the bus for most college athletics programs.
One of the things that was pointed out to me a few years ago about college football was that as a source of, I guess for lack of a better word, advertising, how much of a dollar value can you place on, for example, this past weekend we had Tennessee playing Texas A&M, and in the middle of the game, you know, those very well done commercials, Tennessee, home of great research and blah, 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 you know, and come to Texas A&M, and they tout all of these things that the students are able to do. That's pretty strong. And if it were not for football, that forum, which is highly watched by millions of eyeballs, that wouldn't be there. And so is there any merit to having that kind of publicity in the big time, you know, Division I?
Oh, yeah, that kind of publicity is invaluable. In fact, most universities have figured out that when athletics is successful, the university is successful, because contributions from athletics, because of the glories of athletic programs, usually spill over into contributions into the university at large. There's definitely a linkage there, and most schools have figured that out.
Our guest is Dr. Bob Lipke of the Civitas Institute. You can read College Football, The Spending Continues at ncivitas.org. Now, you start your article, Bob, about how in the past several years since the Great Recession, while on the one hand budgets have been tightened across many avenues and pieces of higher education, the median athletics expenditure among a group of 200 Division I public universities rose by nearly 30%. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and I'm talking about an article that was listed in this past week's Chronicle of Higher Education, which is talking about athletic spending. And the data used in the article were 200 schools, but they were Subdivision One, which were basically not in the five major athletics conferences. But by and large, one of the things that that these schools have in common is that they aspire to be in one of the five major football conferences.
Right.
So, and what we can say there is that these are schools that are invested in football. They believe they can do well at football. And over the last, if you look at the data that was listed in the article, it's expensive to play football and get in even more so. But this is, you know, as you said, there are a lot of layers to this issue. And obviously, you know, when we talk about football, oftentimes if we talk about like this week's games and so forth, most of the time we're talking about large schools like Alabama,
right,
Notre Dame, Michigan, et cetera. And those are, you know, what are called, you know, Division One. You know, they're members of generally the five conferences.
The Power Five.
And underneath that is what we're talking about today is these schools that are not necessarily in those conferences, but are aspiring to be, and, you know, what it costs, you know, to kind of wiggle your way into it. And that's generally, I mean, that's what we're talking about. And my main point in the article was that it's very expensive to do that. And oftentimes the way the narrative is set up, you know, you have to hire a coach, you have to hire a big-time coach, you have to get a stadium, you hopefully can get in a television deal, et cetera, et cetera. It costs a lot of money to be able to do that. And if you don't have a good team right away and the seats aren't filled, you can be in considerable financial trouble, and somebody's got to pay the bills.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, and it made me think back to how, and you mentioned the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and the 49ers were very excited about their football program as recently as 2010, and they've experienced what you just described. They have not been able to field a consistently winning team and generate the kind of excitement necessary to fill the bleachers, to fill the stadium, and so they're having some financial problems.
Yeah, they're one of the schools that was listed in the article. In fact, they had the dubious distinction of having had the highest increase in football expenditures from 2010 to 2014, which was a 76% increase.
Wow!
Now that, you know, what's involved with that? That, well, they had to give raises to coaches. They had to. You know, what's involved in that is also, you know, increases in travel costs. Also, they built a stadium. And so all those things had to be funded. And when you start a football program, it's very expensive, but you have ongoing costs, and then you have costs that, you know, you hope are going to recoup from, you know, good play on the field, which helps to fill the seats, you know, television deals, which they had hoped to have gotten, you know, from a local partner, but hasn't worked out exactly the way they had hoped. Mm. And it's expensive, and it's a big risk. And if it doesn't turn out, you still have to pay. And the point here is the expenses. I mean, in 2014-15, UNC Charlotte football expenditures were about $30 million. And
$30 million.
Yeah, the revenue wasn't necessarily coming in from people in the seats.
Yeah.
So what's happening, you can see, and, you know, if you look at a lot of the tuition and fees, as we all know, anybody who sends children to the UNC system, fees are going up exorbitantly, or have been. They will not go up any more than 3% because of what we had talked about in new legislation. But over the last 5 years, five, 6 years, make a long story short, UNC Charlotte has been getting $18 million of the $30 million budget has been coming from student fees, because the student fees have increased, you know, dramatically. And we're talking about, you know, almost doubling in 5 years.
Yeah, you point out in the article that in 2004, a UNC Charlotte student paid $365 in athletic fees.
Yeah.
In 2014-15, those same fees were $747.
Yeah, I just checked it for this fall. Now it's gone up to $802.
Wow.
So it's gone up even more. So what's the point of all this is it seems like, you know, to pay the freight, it's the dollars and cents are coming in large part from students now.
Our guest is Dr. Bob Lipke of the Civitas Institute, education policy analyst. Now, I think another thing, Bob, that you would probably agree on is that a school like UNC Charlotte has a nice booster base, but it's nothing to be compared with a Duke or a North Carolina or an Alabama or an NC State. You know, at State, you've got, you know, the Murphy name, and there's just not a big donor base on the same scale as the bigger universities. Therefore, they're almost forced to go the route of increasing these fees, like you've said.
Yeah, I mean, this is a complicated topic because I don't want to get into the position of telling schools what to do.
Right.
You know, but oftentimes, if you look at these schools that have been successful, they've been around for a long time.
Yeah.
You kind of grow and evolve into a program, and they have a fan base and so forth. What it's difficult to do is for an institution to kind of bypass, you know, the eras of success and the eras where things are, you know, thin.
Yeah.
The victories are few and far between, and grow a fan base. And what's happening is there are a lot of institutions now that are trying to do that and trying to break onto the scene quickly, you know, in 4 or 5 years and have instant success. And it's hard to do financially. It's hard to do institutionally. And we see it, and that's kind of what we're talking about.
Now, you had another interesting comment in this article that you've posted. While Charlotte's enrollment is growing, they have experienced a $900,000 a year decline in its share of the conference television agreement. That's a significant amount of money to lose.
Yeah, that is a lot of money, especially for an institution like Charlotte that, you know, is not in these a big five conference where, you know, they might be able to pad the losses with something else. So it's a significant amount of money. And what we're saying is institutions that decide to make these kind of microwave trips into the big time,
yeah,
you know, and try to get there in a short amount of time, there's a little wiggle room. If things go wrong, it can go terribly wrong.
Well, and I noticed that you said in 2010, revenue included $10 million to name the stadium. That's a one-time thing. You know, you don't name the stadium every year.
That's right.
And $15 million from seat licenses, that's typically not an ongoing thing. You know, people buy a seat license, and normally they hold on to it for quite some time. And so, you know, I hadn't really thought about this before, but some of these mid-sized schools that want to, you know, quote, play with the big boys, it's expensive, and it looks like from your article, finding that money is an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, football is a very expensive sport.
Yeah.
It's a sport that a lot of us love, but you have to realize if from a school's perspective, it takes a lot to start a program. That's what Charlotte's trying to do. You can't break into it into big-time sports without great expense. And oftentimes, you know, there are some bumps and bruises that come along the way. And if you have a couple of bad turns and a couple of bad years where people stay away from the stadium, I mean, it can hurt. And right now, I think they're finding that out. And in the interim, students are paying the price.
So let me just deviate from the text of your article for a moment. You hear people say all the time, you know, they hear that a coach like Nick Saban in Alabama gets paid, you know, I don't even know what it is, $7, $8, $9 million a year to coach. And you hear about the, you know, the millions that are spent in college football for stadiums and all of this other kind of stuff. Is this a good thing? Is this the free market? I mean, seriously, is this really an example of the free market? Because that's what's determining these contracts. I mean, you have a winning coach like Nick Saban, 5 national championships. Doesn't the market determine how much he's going to get paid? And is college athletics really a good example of the free market at work?
Well, the free market at work assumes rationality. And a lot of times if you can assume the rationality of sports fans.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Nick Saban is paid what people think he's worth. Mike Krzyzewski is paid what people think he's worth. You know, and you talked a little bit before about publicity for institutions. The publicity that Alabama gets, that Duke gets from being on TV all the time.
Yeah.
It's hard to put a dollar figure on that. I grew up in Wisconsin in 1977. Marquette University, of which my dad is an alumnus, won the national, the NCAA basketball tournament.
Al McGuire, yeah, I remember.
Yes, Al McGuire's last game. And the next year, Marquette experienced something like a 50% spike in admissions. Now, that was tied to, everyone assumes, and I think rightfully, that much of that had to do with the publicity that came from the NCAA tournament.
Sure.
And I think that glow, that benefit, continues on today, that those being on television and so forth is tremendous exposure to institutions. You see, anytime you watch a college football game, there's a 30-minute, 30 or 60-second vignette about, you know, what the institution does regarding research, their graduates, et cetera, a little commercial, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, to get their message out, that's invaluable because people watch it. You know, people say, well, Nick Saban makes $5 million, Mike Krzyzewski makes $9 million. How is that right?
Yeah.
The powers that be have determined that the benefits that those individuals bring to the university, you know, justify those expenditures.
Yeah.
And I think you can make a compelling case. Now, does it mean that people that make less are any less valuable? No.
Right.
But, you know, it's a whole other question of getting into the marriage of academics and athletics. But
yeah,
if you're talking about, if a football coach should make this much, can you make a compelling argument that they benefit the university? I think you can.
Well, it certainly is fascinating, and I love football, so I could talk about it all day long. But one other thing that I wanted to ask about, or at least point out, is as you were talking about UNC Charlotte, I was thinking about Appalachian State. Now, they have had good success. They won the, I guess it was the FCS title or whatever it was called back when they won the national championship, beat a big time in school in Michigan not so long ago, almost beat whoever it was they played at the beginning of the season this
Tennessee,
that's right.
Yeah.
So they seem to be on the other side, FBS, FBS title. They seem to be on the other side of the scale, like a UNC Charlotte struggling, trying to find their way. Here's Appalachian State that is actually fielding a successful team. They moved up into the Division I, and they're trying to play with the big boys. And,
yeah.
But is that a good example of a team that is?
Yeah, I'd use that. I would apply the crock pot methodology. We're talking about microwaves.
Yeah.
Appalachian State has been around a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and they've experienced great success. I'm not totally familiar with the program, but like most, I would imagine they've had up and down years too. But they've built a program over the years, and along with that comes a faithful alumni base, which I know they have here.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they have around North Carolina.
Absolutely.
So that's a little bit different from Charlotte, which is fairly new. But it's a good example of, you know, what programs have to do and go through to build themselves.
Yeah. Well, this is good stuff, Bob. Always a pleasure to read what you write, and you can find college football. The spending continues at nccivitas.org. And later on today, I will grab you out in the hallway and we'll talk about whether the Packers will beat the Cowboys this weekend. But
they will.
Well, good. I'm glad you've heard it here first. Dr. Bob Lipke, always a pleasure to have you on What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you very much.
Good to be here, Mark.
One of the earmarks of somebody who really is good at what they do is not only being able to drill down into numbers and statistics and teacher pay and trends and demographics, but also to be able to take something practical that is certainly one of the most favorite pastimes in America, college football, and look at it, you know, from an analytical perspective, and to be able to produce an article that we can read and we can understand that some of these schools trying to get into the big game, so to speak, are struggling, and we can see academic fees going up at a place like UNC Charlotte. So good work. Dr. Bob Lipke here. Always a pleasure to have his insight on what matters in North Carolina. Hope you enjoyed that. Well, by the way, we have a lot going on for you. We've been very active this week. Please avail yourself of freedomactionnetwork.com. As I mentioned at the top of the program, the great women's program we had on Tuesday. Also, yesterday, talking about the tax study that really is amazing. And it's another thing that is easy to read. You know, some of this economic stuff is tough, at least it is for me. But you can find that, go to the nccivitas.org. It'll take you right to the website for this amazing tax study showing all of the good things that are happening in North Carolina as a result of tax reform, unemployment insurance reform, and the amazing speed in which the state recovered from being in debt and is now leading the nation in many categories of economic growth. So if you missed that show yesterday, again, download it at freedomactionnetwork.com or go to the iTunes or Google Play stores and just set your phone or your computer to subscribe. And that way you'll never miss a minute of What Matters in North Carolina. The big debate tonight between incumbent Senator Richard Burr and Deborah Ross, former member of the North Carolina General Assembly. I guess I sort of have to watch this because of what I do. But, oh boy, you know, after the fireworks Sunday between the Donald and Hillary and then a great performance by Governor McCrory in his debate with Roy Cooper, they're going to have to come hard to really grab my attention and that of a lot of others. I'm just joking. Of course, I'll watch it and be able to talk to you tomorrow intelligently about that debate. So thank you very much for listening, as always, here on What Matters in North Carolina. We do appreciate it. And feel free to engage with us, as always, on Twitter, at WhatMattersNC. And tomorrow, we will have another excellent show for you. And in the next couple of days, we're actually going to be heading to Kinston and talking with the mayor, B.J. Murphy, down there. As you know, Matthew left about the middle of the day Sunday, but my goodness, it's still here in a lot of ways. And those folks down east, Neuse River and other rivers and streams and creeks continuing to rise, and that's not a good thing. So we'll look forward to talking to Mayor Murphy about that. Probably talk to him on Monday. But watch the debate tonight. Listen to what Senator Burr has to say. Listen to what Deborah Ross has to say. It never hurts, whether you're a conservative or liberal or moderate, whatever you call yourself, it never hurts to get as much information as you can. And again, that's why we are here. Be sure to tell your friends and family about What Matters in North Carolina. And we will look forward to getting together again with you tomorrow and talking about things that matter in North Carolina. Thank you very much. Have a great day.